Our study at this time is continuing in the 33rd chapter of Deuteronomy. We're ready to begin at the 18th verse. Moses is continuing his blessings to the various tribes, and the next tribes that we're going to study about are going to be those of Zebulun and Issachar. So begin with verse 18, "And of Zebulun he said, Rejoice, Zebulun, in thy going out, and Issachar, in thy tents. They shall call the people unto the mountain, for they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness, for they shall suck of the abundance of the seas, and of treasures hid in the sand." It seems that the blessings of these two tribes are included together in these two verses, verses 18 and 19. "And of Zebulun he said, Rejoice, Zebulun, in thy going out, and Issachar, in thy tents." Zebulun was a tribe that was located by the sea, and they were men who had to do with the merchandising of the sea. They were a haven of ships, and so they were a more of a mobile merchant type of a tribe. They also were very powerful in warfare, as we're going to see, whereas the tribe of Issachar dwelt more on the inland area. They rejoiced in their tents, and they were more people of the farm and agrarian type society. In Genesis 49, when Jacob was giving his blessing on these two tribes, beginning with the 13th verse, we find, "Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea. He shall be for an haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. Issachar is a strong ass couching down between two burdens, and he saw that rest was good, and the land that it was pleasant, and bowed his shoulder to bear, and became a servant unto tribute." So even there we see that these two tribes were to have a different character. One was to be of the sea, a haven of ships. The other was to be of the land and to dwell in the tents. And that's very much the thought of what Moses says in the blessing that he gives here. It seems that verse 19 is a blessing including both tribes. "They shall call the people unto the mountain." This, of course, is referring to the temple or to the worship place of God. These tribes would be instrumental in calling the people unto the mountain. That is, they would be instrumental in seeing that the worship was carried out at the appointed time. They would be productive in carrying the message forth to other people, to continuing the service of God by the reminding of the people that they were to go and worship. They shall call the people unto the mountain. It seems that some attribute to the tribe of Issachar the ability to be especially aware of the times. As we know, there were no almanacs of that time, and maybe no calendars as accurate as ours are, but these men of the land of Zebulun kept up with the times very meticulously, apparently, and they then could be certain that the feast days and the religious rites were kept up at the proper times. In 1 Chronicles 12, beginning with the 32nd verse, "And of the men of Issachar, which were men that had understanding of the times, to know what Israel ought to do, the heads of them were 200, and all their brethren were at their commandment. And of Zebulun, such as went forth to battle, expert in war, with all instruments of war, 50,000, which could keep rank, they were not of double heart." So we see there that these two tribes are characterized in Chronicles, Issachar being the one that had the understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. Now this could very well have to do with their calling the people to the mountain to worship God. Whereas Zebulun went forth to battle, expert in war, with all the instruments of war, they were the tribe that would rejoice in their going out. They were a mobile tribe, and they were one that didn't just settle down to a nice, peaceful life living in the country. Another interesting thing here is, and speaking of they shall call the people unto the mountain, we learn that this tribe of Zebulun was the first place that Jesus preached the gospel. in Matthew 4, beginning with the 12th verse. Now when Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, he departed unto Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the sea coast, in the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people which sat in darkness saw great light, and to them which sat in the region and shadow of death, light is sprung up. From that time Jesus began to preach and to say, Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So this statement, they shall call the people unto the mountain, may very well be a prophecy that had its eventual ultimate fulfillment in the beginning of the ministry of Jesus Christ in that area. And then he says, There they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness. So they not only call people to the mountain or to the place of worship, to the temple, but they offer sacrifices of righteousness. That is, the sacrifices will be acceptable to God. They'll be righteous type sacrifices. So it's not enough just to go to the temple, to just go to the place to worship, but it's also important that you do the right thing after you get there. And the sacrifices they offered then would be righteous sacrifices. And he further elaborates on that, For they shall suck of the abundance of the seas and of treasures hid in the sand. Now the abundance of the seas, of course, could still refer to Zebulun being a seafaring people, a haven of ships, merchants, and in that sense then sucking of the abundance of the seas. And this phrase of treasures hid in the sand might refer to Issachar being a nation of people who like to live on the land, to dwell in the tents, and to partake of the abundance of the land, so they get the treasures hid in the sand. This also could refer to minerals or any kind of a mining operation out of the sand or the soil. It could even refer to the sand on the edge of the sea. But we see then these two tribes taking treasures and abundance from the sea and from the sand, or from the land. Here again, this could have to do with the spread of the gospel and the converting of the Gentiles. For we see Isaiah in the 60th chapter says some things that are very much along this same line. Isaiah 60, verse 5. Then thou shalt see and flow together, and thine heart shall fear and be enlarged, because the abundance of the sea shall be converted unto thee, the forces of the Gentiles shall come unto thee. So there he's talking about converting the abundance of the sea, and that being the forces of the Gentiles. And so that can go right in harmony with this suck of the abundance of the seas. Again in Isaiah 60, verse 16, Thou shalt also suck the milk of the Gentiles, and suck the breast of kings, and thou shalt know that I the Lord am thy Savior, and thy Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. So there again, that passage refers of sucking the milk of Gentiles and the breast of kings, and it has to do with the converting of the Gentiles and the using of the talents and the wealth of the Gentiles in the household of God. Now, another interesting thing to note in this blessing given to these two tribes is that God does not intend for all of us to be exactly alike and to do exactly the same things. Here one tribe was a haven of ships, more of a merchant-type people. They rejoiced in their going out, being mobile. They were fierce warriors. Another tribe was content to dwell in tents, to stay at home, to be more of a farming type people, to observe the times, and to be able to call the people to worship. And each one was content in what he was doing. Each one rejoiced in this. One rejoiced in going out, one rejoiced in staying in the tents. And so it is even with us today. We're not all disposed to do exactly the same things. Even in the church, we're each one a different member of the body, and we each one have to contribute our part to that body as a whole. And this thought is brought forth quite nicely in 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, beginning with the 12th verse, talking about the makeup of the church. He says, "For as the body is one, and hath many members, and all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit are we all baptized into one body, whether we be Jews or Gentiles, whether we be bond or free, and have been all made to drink into one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. For if the foot shall say, Because I am not the hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear shall say, Because I am not of the eye, I am not the eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? But now hath God set the members, every one of them, in the body, as it hath pleased him. And if they were all one member, where were the body? But now are they many members, yet but one body." And I think that gives us the thought there, showing that even in the church, we have different abilities, different functions, yet we're all members of the same body, and we're all working for the common cause. Just as these two tribes, one was a seafaring people, one was a land-dwelling people, yet they were working for the common cause of the good of the nation of Israel and for the cause of God. And so it's very beautiful then to see that God uses these different abilities, different dispositions of men, yet they can each one be happy in his own abilities and the things that he does, the things that he enjoys doing, and still be well-pleasing unto God. In verses 20 and 21, we have the blessing given to Gad. "And of Gad he said, Blessed be he that enlargeth Gad. He dwelleth as a lion, and teareth the arm with the crown of the head. And he provideth the first part for himself, because there, in the portion of the lawgiver, was he seated. And he came with the heads of the people, and he executed the justice of the Lord, and his judgments with Israel." This is a very beneficial blessing given to Gad. First thing he says is, "Blessed be he that enlargeth Gad." That is, he predicts that Gad will be enlarged, and he places a blessing on that enlargement, or on the ones who participated in the enlargement of Gad. And we do find that in 1 Chronicles, the 5th chapter, that the tribe of Gad was enlarged. Beginning in 1 Chronicles 5, with verse 19, "And they made war with the Hagarites, with Jetur, and Nepish, and Nobadab. And they were helped against them, and the Hagarites were delivered into their hand, and all that were with them, for they cried to God in the battle, and he was entreated of them, because they put their trust in him. And they took away their cattle, of their camels 50,000, and of sheep 250,000, and of asses 2,000, and of men 100,000. For there fell down many slain, because the war was of God, and they dwelt in their steads until the captivity." So this tribe of Gad was enlarged. It was a righteous type war, because God was with them in the war, and he gave them the victory. And they dwelt in this land that they captured, until then they were finally taken into captivity themselves because of disobedience. Then he further says, "He dwelleth as a lion." Now, to dwell as a lion means that he has a lot of physical prowess. He has the ability to defend and to be valiant in battle. He has the ability to command this area, to be the ruler of it. And he is not in subjection to any. He dwelleth as a lion. And teareth the arm with the crown of the head. When he did engage in a conflict, in a battle, he was able to do like the lion did. He could tear the arm and the crown of the head. So that it was a very fierce conflict. And he would be a formidable opponent. Anything that can fight like a lion, then it can tear the arm and the head, is going to devastate then whatever is opposing him. And then verse 21, he provideth the first part for himself. As we know, Gad was one of the three tribes that did settle east of the Jordan, and they had already received their inheritance at the time Moses was giving this. And so he is named here as providing the first part for himself, because there, in a portion of the lawgiver, was he seated. That is, he received his territory, his lot, from Moses himself, just as Reuben and half of Manasseh did, whereas the other tribes had to wait until they got into the land of Canaan, until they had victoriously conquered the land, and then they were assigned their portion by Joshua. But Gad was one of the tribes that had his portion assigned to him by Moses himself, and a portion of the lawgiver was he seated. Then he further says, and he came with the heads of the people. He executed the justice of the Lord and his judgments with Israel. Now, as you remember, those three tribes that were given this portion east of the Jordan before they went into Canaan had to agree that when the crossing was made into Jordan, that they would then go with the other tribes, that is, the males who were able to engage in warfare, would go with the other tribes and help them to successfully conquer the land of Canaan, and then they could come back and occupy this territory where they had left their families. And so he says he came with the heads of the people. That is, he came with those that were ruling and making the decisions for the people. He came with them, and he executed the justice of the Lord and his judgments with Israel. He helped to carry out the things the Lord wanted done. He helped to carry out the battle. He executed the justice of the Lord and his judgments with Israel. As we remember, these people who lived in the land of Canaan were only allowed by God to borrow this land for a temporary time. Although it might have been for several hundred years, it was a temporary time, really, in the eyes of God. And they did not really own the land as God would have a people to own the land. And so when it came time for him to bring his people into the land, it was a just thing with God. It was a part of the judgment of God for these Israelites to be successful in conquering the land. And so he simply is talking about the fact that Gad executed the justice of the Lord and his judgments with Israel. They helped to carry out the victorious conquering of the land of Canaan. And that's mentioned here in this blessing to Gad and the prophecy about what would become of the tribe. In verse 22, he gives the blessing to Dan. And of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's whelp. He shall leap from Bashan. Now, to be compared to a lion's whelp is a young lion. A lion, when it's in its very prime, and can be a very fierce animal. And this mountain of Bashan was noted for having lions to dwell there and to come down off the mountain and to leap on the prey of the plains. Now, there is one occasion in Judges 18:27 where men from the tribe of Dan conquered the city of Laish, and they renamed it Dan after their father. And it was close to this mountain of Bashan, and that could be a reference to that occasion in which they more than likely did use that mountain as a part of their procedure in taking the land of Laish. It also could refer to Samson, who came from the tribe of Dan, and who was very instrumental in the defeating of the Philistines. And Samson began while he was yet a young man, and could be described as being like a lion's whelp in that sense. But in any sense, this prophecy refers to Dan then as being a tribe that's going to be a fierce tribe, one that is going to have the ability to protect itself and also to conquer its enemies. In verse 23, we have the blessing given to Naphtali. And of Naphtali he said, O Naphtali, satisfied with favor, and full with the blessing of the Lord. Possess thou the west and the south. This blessing to Naphtali included several very beneficial characteristics. First of all, he describes him as being satisfied with favor. Now, this is a condition that we ought to all strive to be in. That is, to be satisfied with the favor that we receive. This could be the favor of other men, but it is more than likely talking about the favor of God. The good things that God has done for them, the blessings that God has given them, they're able to be satisfied with it. You know, it matters not how much we get in this life, what kind of blessing, what kind of favor we receive, until we arrive at the point that we're able to be satisfied with what we have. We can say, I have enough. I can be happy if I never get any more. Until we arrive at that point, we're never going to be happy. We're never going to be satisfied. So this being able to be satisfied with favor is a frame of mind that is truly a very, very great blessing. Well, this tribe, he said, would be satisfied with favor and full with the blessing of the Lord. Now, they were very muchly blessed. According to the ancient Jews, this tribe was so blessed until they were the first ones to bring the first fruits to the temple. And consequently, then they received the first blessings of the priest, being the first ones with their first fruits. And so they were in a very favored position. They received the blessing of the Lord in abundance. They were satisfied with it. And so they were a very contented and prosperous tribe. In the blessing that Jacob gives to this tribe in Genesis 49:21, Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. So the implication there is that it's going to be a joyful, pleasant tribe, one that giveth goodly words. That is, not only in the sense of good advice, but in all probability he would be returning thanks for the blessings and reflecting the fact that he was very appreciative of the blessings of God. He giveth goodly words. And he further says, possess thou the west and the south. This word west here can be translated as sea. Some do translate it as sea. Possess thou the sea and the south. And as we know, this tribe did border on the Sea of Galilee, which is, of course, a very prominent sea. It's very prominent in the Gospels and in the preaching of the Gospel by Jesus Christ. The cities of Capernaum and Bethsaida were in this tribe. They did prosper very muchly from the products of the Sea of Galilee, from the fishing and commerce, as those cities and their wealth can rightly testify. And so they did possess this. It was in Naphtali that the gospel did begin to be preached by the Savior. And so Moses foresaw in his blessing here, through prophetic knowledge, where this tribe would be placed, and the favored position that they would have. And in verses 24 and 25, we have the blessing to the tribe of Asher. And of Asher he said, let Asher be blessed with children, let him be acceptable to his brethren, and let him dip his foot in oil. Thy shoes shall be iron and brass, and as thy days, so shall thy strength be. This blessing to Asher is about five different parts here. We find that when Asher was born, in Genesis 30:13, his mother Leah said, happy am I. And so Asher seems to be a tribe that is abundantly blessed. The first blessing, let Asher be blessed with children. Now, at the time of the numbering, they were a very numerous tribe at that time. And according to this blessing of Moses, they would continue to have great numbers. And any time we have children that are faithful and acceptable to God and are still living according to the covenant of God, then these children are necessarily a great, great blessing. So that's the first thing. Let Asher be blessed with children. Then he says, let him be acceptable to his brethren. This would be another great blessing that Asher would have, that he would be acceptable to his brethren. He would have the good favor of those round about him. Now, this is an important thing for all people, to be able to get along with those round about them, to be acceptable to those that that they have to deal with. You know, even in the New Testament age, one of the qualifications for an elder was that he have a good report of those that are without. And this is a necessary thing for all of us. We are not to needlessly incur the disfavor of those with whom we have to deal. We're to try to get along with them, try to be acceptable and pleasing to them. Otherwise, we have no way to have any kind of a favorable influence upon them. So this blessing of being acceptable to his brethren is a very great blessing, one that we ought to all strive to attain. For if we needlessly cause someone to have a bad feeling toward us, then we have cut off our opportunity to be able to influence that person into following after the true and living God. The next blessing, and let him dip his foot in oil. This seems to imply that his land would be so fruitful that he would have enough oil that he could not only anoint his head with it, but he could also dip his foot in it. And as you know, in the case of our Savior, he had such great favor with some of those that were his brethren that they anointed his feet with precious oil. Then the next blessing, thy shoes shall be iron and brass. Now this could imply that not only would the surface of their land be fruitful in that they had much oil, but that the land beneath the surface would also be fruitful in that it would supply these minerals of iron and brass through the mining of the land. Now that's very much a possibility. Some interpret this figuratively to simply say that the tribe of Asher would shine forth like brass and iron. Then the last blessing, and as thy day, so shall thy strength be. That is, regardless of how long or how old the people were, they would continue to have strength as long as they had days. Now that is truly a very, very great blessing. You know, many, many times we see people who really outlive their usefulness in that they just become almost in a vegetative state. They hardly know how to even feed themselves and cannot give themselves their own personal care. They lose their strength before they lose their days. But he says that here in the case of Asher, that your days are going to have strength. You're going to have strength as long as you have days. And any time that there is a job to be done that's appropriate for you in your day and your age, you're going to have the strength to carry it out. And that truly would be a very, very great blessing. So this blessing that Moses gives to Asher is a very beneficial one, and one that we ought to all strive to try to attain to ourselves. So at this point, we come to the end of the blessings given by Moses to the tribes of Israel. And certainly we do find many interesting and beneficial things as we study about these blessings. Beginning at the 26th verse and through the remainder of the chapter, verse 29, we have the last words of Moses, the last things that Moses said that are recorded in the Bible. And in these last few statements, Moses magnifies the God of Israel and the Israel of God. In his mind, there was no God like the God of Israel. And by the same things that Moses said that are, and certainly we do find many interesting and beneficial things as we study about these blessings. Beginning at the 20th and beneficial things as we study about these blessings. Beginning at the 26th verse and through the remainder of the chapter, verse 29, we have the last words of Moses, the last things that Moses said that are recorded in the Bible. And in these last few statements, Moses magnifies the God of Israel and the Israel of God. In his mind, there was no God like the God of Israel. And by the same token, there was no people like the Israel of God. And Moses was in a place to know both very well, and he also was willing to give his life for either or both of them, should the occasion arise. So it begins in verse 26, there is none like unto the God of Jeshurun, who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. So in this first part of the passage, he magnifies the God of Israel. There is none like unto the God of Jeshurun. Of course, the word Jeshurun is a name meaning the favored or blessed people of God, a name referring to the Israelite people. And one of the best ways, if not the best way, that we can magnify God is to simply state and realize that there is none like unto the God of Jeshurun. There is no God like him. He is unequaled. He is unparalleled. There is nobody who even approaches near to the magnificence, the glory, the power, the ability that this God has. There is no other true and living God. There is none like unto him. And so anytime we have an opportunity to praise God, the first thing we ought to think about is the fact that there is no God like him. He is the one and the only God. There is none like unto him. And that's what Moses says. There is none like to the God of Jeshurun. And then he gives some descriptions of this God and his ability. Who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. This God has control of all the universe. He is depicted here as he gives help to his people of riding upon the heaven. There is none to obstruct him. There is no way that he can be halted or deterred from his desire to help. He can ride upon the heaven. He can go from one end of the heaven to the other. He can be in all places at once if need so arise. And he does this in the helping of his people and in his excellency on the sky. He is an excellent God. He excels at everything that he does. There is nothing that he falters in. There is nothing that he is imperfect in. And this excellency is written on the sky. He is there. He is present everywhere the sky is. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. This is an everlasting God. He never comes to an end. He is going to live forever. He is the eternal God, whereas the idols and the lesser gods that the people take round about us are late comers. They're new arrivals upon the scene, and they're going to last only temporarily. They're not going to exist anywhere near eternity. This God is the eternal God. He is the God that's going to be everlasting. His arms are everlasting. And consequently then, there is no surer foundation. There is no more security. There is no more peace. There is no more feeling of well-being that we can accomplish than by coming to this God. For this is the eternal God. This is the everlasting God. And that's the description that Moses gives of him, which is very true and accurate. In the book of Habakkuk, chapter 1, verse 12, "Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction." So this God is an everlasting God. And when we are a part of him, when we become a part of his family, then we are allowed to inherit that everlastingness also. We are given a promise of eternal life, of an inheritance with him. And consequently then, this is one of the greatest features of our God. The fact that he is an everlasting God, and that we too can become everlasting by being a part of him. Next, we find that Moses establishes the fact that there is no people like this Israel of God. No people like this people. Not only did they have a God that was not like any other God, he had all sovereign power and authority by riding upon the heavens. He had boundless eternity by being the eternal and everlasting God. But then they were his people, and they then, by having a covenant with him, could have everlasting happiness, and he then was the honor of Israel, and consequently, it made them also have a reflected honor and glory of their own, so they became a peculiar people, different from many other people. This same principle applies today. We also can be highly elevated. We can be a people like no other people simply because of our association with this God that is like no other God. So, after having pronounced each tribe happy in these blessings that he gave to the tribes, Moses now talks to all the people. And he pronounces all together to be very happy by saying, "Happy art thou, O Israel." A people whose God is this God. A people who are attributing to God the features of being a God that no other God is like. They then, in turn, will be counted as a people that no other people are like. And whatever is said here of the Church of Israel, the honors and the privileges that apply to it also are applied to the Church of the Firstborn. We find in Galatians 6, verse 16, that the Apostle Paul there refers to the Church as the Israel of God. So he now begins to enumerate the qualities of Israel in showing their superior position with this true and living God. He says, "The eternal God is thy refuge," in verse 27. That is, there is no people so well seated as this people are. They have a secure position. They can always turn to God for their protection. They will not be rooted out from their habitation as long as they're in favor with this God, because he is thy refuge. And truly, there are times in this life in which we do need a refuge. We do need some place to turn to, some place of security and shelter. And this living God is the place. He is the one to turn to for refuge. And then the second thing is, never was there a people so well supported. Underneath are the everlasting arms. God was going to give them support in all of their endeavors that were in accordance with his will. And this is true of his people in all ages. So that the course of events of world history are altered many times for the benefit of God's people, for the benefit of his nation, for the benefit of the church. And consequently then, we are supported. We have the everlasting arms that are underneath. And many times we do not even know what God has in mind for us. We do not know what God's plans are. But they are all working together then for the harmony and for the benefit of his purpose and his people. So there is support here that is beyond all imagination. And then he talks about how never should a people have the victory that they have. "And he shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall say, destroy them." They're given assurance of the victory. First of all, he shall say, destroy them. That is, they're given a commission to go into battle. He has ordained a spiritual and righteous warfare to be carried on by his people. In the days of Israel, we can read about all these battles and wars in the Old Testament. In the days of the church, these battles that we now have are spiritual battles. We fight with spiritual wickedness in high places. Our enemy happens to be the forces of darkness. And we do not use carnal weapons in our warfare today. But our weapons are mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds and imaginations that are against God. And the bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience to Christ. Consequently, we are in a warfare. We have been given a divine commission. And he shall thrust out the enemy from before thee. We can have the victory. There's no question about that. We can have the victory today. We can have Satan to flee from us just simply by resisting him. We've been given this promise. Just as surely as they could go into the land of Canaan in these days that we read about in Deuteronomy and root out the enemy and possess the land, today we can root out the enemy that's against us, and we can possess the land that is the church, and we can be successful in the victory because we had the promise of it. So this God will do this for this people, and it makes the people then a people that are invincible, that have assurance of the victory. Then in verse 28, Israel then shall dwell in safety. Now, never was there a people so secured as this people were. They should dwell in safety. He's going to let them live in safety without the fear of molestation, without the fear of being, again, whisked away from the security of their position in Canaan. Now, of course, all this was contingent upon them continuing to follow this true and living God. If they left the God, then they left their safety, and they would no longer be secured. But as long as they followed the true and living God, they shall dwell in safety alone. Now that is a very beneficial promise. That's one that we all would love to have, to be able to dwell in safety alone, to know that we are secure, to know that we do not have to worry about somebody taking our place or rooting us out or diminishing our portion. And that's exactly what he promises them here, to dwell in safety alone. Then he further says, the fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine, also as heaven shall drop down dew. So this people are going to be well provided for. While they were living in this land of Canaan, this land that was a very productive land, he would favor them. The fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine. Also, the heavens shall drop down the dew. They're going to have the rain. They're going to have the rivers. They're going to be able to provide all the favorable conditions so that this fertile and productive land could truly be a land of corn and wine. And so they'd be a well provided for people by God. You know, we can have a very expensive piece of land and all so productive, but if we can't get the water to it, if we can't get the favorable weather conditions, we're not going to make the right kind of a crop. And he promises here that he will be with them so that they can do these things. So in verse 29, in the very midst of his giving these superior descriptions of this people, he says, "Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, O people." Happy art thou. No other nation as happy as this people could be. Happy art thou, O Israel. And that truly is one of the greatest of all blessings, for us to not only be well seated with a refuge, to be well supported, to be given the victory, to be secured, to be provided for, but to, in the midst of all this, to be happy, to enjoy it, to have this feeling of well-being, this feeling of a pleasure. Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee. That is very, very true of the church today. There is no people like the people in the church. The church is composed of a peculiar people, a called out nation, a nation of priests, a holy nation, and they are different from those round about. Not different for the sake of being different, but different because they are following the true and living God, and those round about are not. And certainly our preference of association and companionship should be with those people who are members of the church. We should prefer their company to the company of all others when opportunity presents itself, so that we truly feel the same way that God feels and that Moses feels about his people, that they're a happy people. There's nobody else like them. Who is like unto thee? And when we get to the point that we cannot be distinguished from the world by our behavior and our actions, and nobody would say, "Who is like unto thee?" because we're just like everybody else, then there's something wrong, because we need to be a people that are so separate and so distinct in our actions and our behavior that somebody could say about us, "Who is like unto thee, O people?" Then he continues to give their qualities. He says, "O people saved by the Lord, the shield of thy help." Never has a people been so helped as this people have been helped. They're counted to be in a saved position. "O people saved by the Lord, the shield of thy help." Now, this in a position of being saved includes all the idea of safety and security and protection. We think of ourselves as being saved today. But let us remember that this condition of being saved is truly conditional upon our being obedient, upon our carrying out our part of the covenant. Anytime we fail to carry out our part of the covenant, God is no longer obligated to carry out his part, and this condition of being saved then can be nullified because we have canceled it out by our actions. This truly did happen to this people that he declares here to be saved. They, by turning to other gods, they, by turning to idolatry, by failing to honor and to obey and to magnify the true and living God, but by playing the harlot with other gods round about them, they lost this position of being saved. But at this point, when they're just fixing to go into the land, when they're just being given this covenant fresh, and everything is favorable for them to go ahead.